And welcome to the 8th edition of the Matt Cummins Fantasy Baseball Podcast. This is your host, Matt Cummins. In this episode, it's always just me here. We finished, I finished the positional previews in the last episode. And I missed last week because I was in Vegas, specifically doing my NFBC drafts. So I wasn't able to record a podcast. But I am now back, and my teams are taking a big dump right now because there's lots of problems with my roster because of various players. But anyway, I'll talk about that in a little bit. But let's get some housekeeping out of the way. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Cummins. You can read my work at mattcummins.com, as well as Through the Fence Baseball, as well as Baseball Professor. So what you'll see at Baseball Professor is some of the things that I've seen in the day prior. So, for example, if I watched Dylan G pitch, then I'll talk about what I saw and, you know, what are my takeaways from the outing. Or if I'm noticing a hitter, you know, is facing the shift a lot more, like with Chris Carter, I will mention that too as well as a potential observation that can help inform you and, you know, help inform you and your fantasy team and so forth like that. At Through the Fence Baseball, I write a weekly starting pitcher rankings article where I rank the top 101 pitchers for the entire week. So this isn't a daily, you know, fantasy rankings for pitchers. If you want that, definitely go to Baseball Professor and read. Who writes that? I think Brian writes that. Yeah, Brian Curley writes that. It's either Brian or George. But either one of them, they write that on a daily basis. So if you play in a daily league, then that's something you definitely want to check out because it's actually really good. So for the first portion of this podcast, I'm going to discuss some of my player takeaways that I've seen so far this season. If you've read my daily roundups at Baseball Professor, the information is going to be somewhat similar because I'm kind of piggybacking off of what I've already written. So let's talk about what I haven't written about yet. And that is, I saw Masahiro Tanaka pitch tonight in Toronto. And actually, I was going to record this podcast, but then I delayed it because I wanted to see the start live. So my overall takeaway is he's pretty good. The splitter looks really good. It's a true bat misser, especially when it's thrown with two strikes, because it looks as though that he throws it at a little bit harder velocity, but also with the faster arm speed a little bit. So, and that generates a lot of swings and misses. But another thing that I noticed is that another reason why I wasn't high on Tanaka entering this year is because the infield defense for the Yankees. So in this game, the infield defense kind of let him down twice during this game. So in the second inning, there were runners on first and second, and there was a ground ball hit to Mark Teixeira, and he went ahead and threw the ball to second base, and the ball went into left field. And that made that, you know, that created a bases loaded situation. Instead of having, you know, first and third and two outs, it was bases loaded with one out. Later on in the game, there was a ground ball hit to Solarte at third base. He should have, it was a routine, not routine, but it was a fairly, it's a ball that he should have got and caught throwing the ball at first place, but he didn't do that. And that created another situation, high leverage situation for Tanaka as well. So overall, my takeaway is that he's going to be pretty good. If he had a good, if he had a competent infield defense behind him, he could be really good, but I don't foresee that happening this year, especially when Derek Jeter is in there at shortstop. Now, today he, quote-unquote, had the day off in order to rest, but I think that has to do with Tanaka being such a ground ball-heavy pitcher that Joe Girardi, the Yankees manager, didn't want to have Jeter out there because he would make Tanaka look bad. Or wouldn't, you know, it would create situations for Tanaka that wouldn't be helpful for his development as a pitcher. So another player I wanted to talk about was Zach Wheeler. So I saw his start, I think it was yesterday. So I'm recording this Friday night. So I think he pitched on Thursday. I'm not entirely sure. So all the days now are running together now that I'm writing this daily column. But so what I noticed was that, first of all, he still has command problems, especially with the fastball. That creates it creates situations where he has runners on base a lot, and he's pitching from the stretch constantly. And in his first game, I think the first batter of every inning got on base with Wheeler out there, and that's never a good sign. So another thing that I noticed is that he has really good raw stuff. Don't get me wrong. He has really good raw stuff, and this guy has the ability to be a number two starter in real life. So, but anyway, I rambled there. But so another thing that I noticed is that his fastball velocity decreased pretty rapidly throughout the game. So in the first inning, the fastball was 95 to 96, but by the fifth inning, when he was nearing 100 pitches, the fastball was now like 93 to 94. And that's a 2 mile per hour difference. And I don't know why that's happening, because that's what was happening last year too as well. If you go to brooksbaseball.net, you'll see that his fastball velocity decreased, after the, fifth inning last year as well. So I don't know why that's happening, but when you have a situation where, you're not throwing a lot of strikes with your fastball, and sometimes you leave your fastball up. He leaves his fastball up sometimes. So what's going on is he's losing velocity on his fastball deeper in the games, and he's leaving the fastball up anyway. And that creates a really bad situation, because that will mean that there's a higher possibility that when you leave the ball up with a slower velocity fastball, those will turn into home runs or much more hard contact. So that, I'm not really buying Zach Wheeler. Sorry. I wasn't a big proponent of Wheeler anyway entering the season because of the command issues. But this is just something that I noticed, and I will be monitoring as the season goes on. Another quick note was Steven Strasburg. In his first start, his velocity was down 2 or 3 miles per hour less than it was last year on the fastball. And I'm not really that concerned with it, because it's only been one start. I want to see what happens in his next start. If it's still, in the 93, 94 range, then I will be concerned about Strasburg's fastball. So, but as of right now, I'm not really worried about it. So another player I wanted to talk about was, CC Sabathia. So I watched his start too, and I think the box score looks pretty bad, but what happened, the majority of that poor box score came in the first two innings, where he gave up all those earned runs. And what was happening in those first two innings was he was leaving the ball up in the zone. That's never good when you're throwing a fastball that's, 88, 89 miles an hour, or 90 miles an hour. But what happened, what no one's really talking about, is how he looked pretty good after the first two innings, where he was throwing the ball down in the zone and generating a lot of weak contact and so forth. So if you go to Baseball Professor, I write a pretty good, well, I think it's pretty good. I think I write a pretty good summary of what's going on with Sabathia. But what I wrote in that article was, just because he's losing velocity on his fastball doesn't mean that he cannot be a successful pitcher. You can't be a successful pitcher. So because I wrote another article a few months ago where I showed the correlation between a declining fastball velocity and the difference in ERA from the year prior. So, and I found that there was basically no correlation at all between the two. So therefore, that tells me just because your fastball decreases in velocity doesn't mean that you can't be successful. And I still believe that Sabathia can be successful. So if I owned him, I would not be dropping him, but I definitely would be sitting him for the next one or two starts to see how he looks moving forward. If he has two bad outings again, then feel free to drop him. Even if you're in a 12-team mixer, you can go ahead and do that. Another pitcher I wanted to talk about was Corey Kluber. Now, if you've read my writing, or if you listen to other podcasts, my other podcasts, you'll know that Corey Kluber was one of my flag players. This is one of the players that I wanted to make sure I owned in every league, because I think he's being very undervalued, because he is a low walk, high strikeout pitcher, and he generates a lot of ground balls. And that is pretty much the ideal type of pitcher that I want. So anyway, so I watched his start on Wednesday in Oakland, and I wasn't able to watch it live because I live in San Francisco and the MLB TV package has a blackout, so I can't watch it. And I'm not paying for cable. I'm not going to be paying $80 a month to watch, you know, the A's and Giants live. I can just wait. It's no big deal. And it's totally a waste of money because I don't even have time anymore to watch TV. But anyway, so I watched the game. He just did not have command of the strike zone. He didn't have it from the first pitch. The box score looks pretty bad, and he pitched poorly. And as I wrote at Baseball Professor, that I'm not jumping ship. I still believe that he can still be a top 30 starting pitcher. So I just chalk it up to one bad start. It's the same thing I feel about Cliff Lee as well. A lot has been talked about Cliff Lee and his bad start in Texas. Again, I'm not really worried. If I see another start from Cliff Lee that's not very good, then I will be worried. But I'm not worried about Cliff Lee either. As well as another player I wanted to talk about was R.A. Dickey. Now, this is a player that I'm not really, again, this guy I feel was, you know, he was a top 30 pitcher for me, and that he was going, he was being undervalued in drafts. And again, you know, what the biggest takeaway that I took from that game was the velocity of the knuckleball was where it's, you know, where it should be. It was in the 77 to 79 range. And last year, the reason why I struggled was that the velocity of the knuckleball was down, which was due to injury. And, you know, on Monday, his velocity was fine on the knuckleball. He just happened to not have really good command of it as he walked quite a few people. But again, you know, I'm still starting him next week, and I have no problem with that. So I'm not worried about him at all. So going back to the A's game with Corey Kluber. So Corey Kluber faced off against Scott Kazmir. And Scott Kazmir actually had a really good game. He changed speeds effectively through the fastball, yeah, in and out of the strike zone. On the inner half and the outer half consistently. And he generated a lot of ground balls, and he looked like a really good starting pitcher. And I wrote also that he's only owned in 10 to 11% of ESPN leagues, and that's far too low, especially since guys like Tim Lincecum are owned in 90% of leagues. That doesn't make any sense. So, but another thing I noticed was that Kazmir went over 7 innings in that start, which is actually really good because last year the big knock on him was, or one of the knocks that I had on him was, he wasn't going deep into the games. He was like only going, you know, maybe 5.5-6 innings last year, which, you know, it's hard to win games if you're going off that early in games because then you leave up the game to the bullpen and so forth. But this, in the first start, he actually went 7+ innings, or maybe it was like 7 1/3 or something like that. But he actually went deep into the game and looked really good. So this is a player that I am definitely buying on. I was actually buying on him regardless, but if you're out there and you're looking for starting pitching, this is a player that I would definitely add as well. Another player that I watched quite closely was Brandon Morrow of the Blue Jays. So some fantasy analysts had this guy as a, you know, as a bounce back player because of the really good 2012 season where he had like a sub 3 ERA and a 20 to 21% strikeout rate, I think. So I really wanted to see how he looked. And one thing I noticed was that he was noticeably bigger than he was last year. So, and then I read this article on MLB.com about how he added 20 pounds of muscle to his frame, hopefully helped make him more durable. That, you know, that's, we'll see if that's actually true or not. But so what I noticed from the Brandon Morrow start was, he wasn't really missing a lot of bats with the fastball. And the secondary stuff, you know, players weren't swinging at it, especially when it was down in the dirt. So they created a lot of hitters counts, and it just led to a lot of hard contact. And he wasn't really missing bats as the way that he used to. Now, for the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, the strikeout rate has been in decline, while at the same time, the walk rate has been decreasing as well. So, and in this game, I think he only walked one batter, which is good, but he also didn't really, you know, miss a lot of bats. So this is a guy that I believe now, you know, the upside the 2012 upside is no longer there. This is more of a streaming option. So at this point, I wouldn't really hold on to him just because of the upside potential. You know, if there's a Scott Kazmir, for example, on the waiver wire, I'd definitely drop Brandon Morrow for Scott Kazmir, for example. So I'd definitely do that. So I guess let's talk about the hitters. So one thing that I noticed is that Chris Carter of the Astros, he's like in the first series against the Yankees put the shift on Chris Carter in every at bat. And that's something that I didn't see a lot of last year. So what I wrote was that if Carter continues to face the shift, his batting average could be even lower than it was last year. Now, last year, he actually, you know, his batting average was fairly high considering that he had a BABIP of like 330 or 340 or something. So even if the BABIP regresses, and then if you combine that with the fact that he's facing the shift more, then, you know, he could literally be a Adam Dunn type of batting average. So that's something to be mindful of if he's going to be facing the shift from more teams this year. So another player is that this player is a catcher, and this is more for if you're in a deep two-catcher league, like a NFBC league. So then that player is Derek Norris. Derek Norris is someone that he's currently in a platoon with John Jaso, but if you watch John Jaso play, he is not a good catcher at all. It's only a matter of time that I believe that Norris seizes the everyday job and becomes the everyday catcher for the A's, and John Jaso becomes the DH. Now, for that to actually happen, there's one more thing that needs to happen as well. So that is with Derek Barton. Surprisingly, Derek Barton made the opening day roster for the A's. And I wrote that, you know, this is still a player that's, you know, in 2011, I think it was 2011, that he had a 5-WAR season where he played, you know, really good defense and had a 270 batting average with like a 400 on base. What I said was that in the last 2 years in AAA, he has like a 280 batting average with, you know, like a 400 OBP. So what I also said was that last year, after his call up in August, in late August, he was actually a 300 hitter and had a 370 OBP. And I believe that, you know, also what happened was at the end of that, after his call up, was that he changed his approach at the plate and started swinging more at balls. And what happened was the contact rate increased such that it was a career high for him last year. So I wrote that it's possible that, you know, he could actually kind of repeat the 2011 season where he had the 270 batting average with a 400 OBP again. So, but anyways, the reason why I brought up Derek Barton was that if Derek Barton is hitting, then John Jaso and Derek Norris will be in a straight platoon. But if Derek Barton doesn't start, if he doesn't hit, then what I think is going to happen is they're going to send Barton back down and they're going to call up Stephen Vogt, and John Jaso will be the DH, and then we'll have Norris as the everyday catcher, and you have, you know, Stephen Vogt acting as the backup catcher. So the last player, well, actually not the last player, but the next player I wanted to talk about was Jesse Chavez of the A's. So I saw his start on Thursday, and the box score looked really good. I think it said that he went 6 innings and gave up 2 runs, 1 earned, and had 4 or 5 strikeouts. So what happened in that game was the defense let him down in the first inning, where Alberto Callaspo muffed a ground ball to first base, and Nick Punda threw the ball into the runner for some reason. But anyway, that doesn't really matter. But anyway, so what happened was, what I noticed from Jesse Chavez was that he threw the cutter a lot. And the cutter was a pitch that he started incorporating a lot more last year. And the cutter in the first 2 or 3 innings, no, the first 3 innings, the cutter was maybe 88 to 91. But in the 4th and 5th and 6th inning, the cutter went from, again, from 88 to 91 to 86 to 88. And in the last inning, the 6th inning, he was clearly starting to look gassed, even though he only pitched or thrown like 80 to 90 pitches. And the velocity dropped. So anyway, so my concern is that the velocity dropped so much that maybe this is a player that maybe can only go five innings before the bullpen has to come in and close the game out for him. So, but also what I noticed is that he has a pretty good changeup. And if he's able to, he only threw a few of them, mostly to lefties. But if he's able to throw the changeup consistently, he can actually have a really good, you know, really true bat mister. But so it flashed pretty good, like a pretty good, but it wasn't there all, you know, it wasn't there the entire game. So, but so this is a player that I'm not really excited about, even though that he is in the Oakland, you know, rotation and pitches half his games in Oakland. This is a guy that, you know, he only throws 88 to 91, even at the high end of his velocity, and doesn't really miss a lot of bats. So, yeah, so another player I wanted to talk about was Ryan Braun. Now, this morning I woke up to how he is still experiencing problems with his thumb and how he can't really feel his thumb right now. And this is the same injury that bothered him all of last year. And for me, when I was evaluating him for the 2014 season, I figured that, okay, he has 5 months off. He should be able to rest his, you know, the ligament in his thumb and he'll be fine. And what happened was, you know, in spring training, we all know that he hit a home run in his first at bat. So I was like, okay, this guy is back to normal. But there's an article at Brewers.com that talks about how it got progressively worse as spring training went on. And now we're at the point where he has problems. He developed blisters on his hand because he can't feel. What's going on is that he's holding the bat really hard, but since he doesn't have feeling in his thumb, he can't really tell that he's holding the bat too hard. And now that he's developing blisters on his hand now. And what the article goes on to say is that Ryan Braun is aware that he could have surgery to correct it, but, you know, the surgery doesn't guarantee that it will work. And, you know, there's actually quite high of likelihood that the surgery will not work, and that could be the end of his career possibly. So that's really known about the injury. But right now I am extremely concerned about this injury, and if I was able to trade him, I would trade him right now, even for, you know, 50 cents on the dollar, because I think this is a player that will probably be on the DL in a month, or at most, or within the next few weeks, and will be gone for the rest of the year. So, which is actually kind of sad, because I picked him in my 15-team NFBC league and spent a lot of money on him, and he was my, you know, my core piece to my team. And so now I'm going to have to be dealing with that now when he's no longer playing. And also, if you look at his stats this year, he's not hitting for power. He only has like one hit. So it doesn't look like this is going to correct itself anytime soon. So again, feel free to trade Ryan Braun faster, sooner than later. Okay, so that is the end of this segment, and I will be back in 1 minute. So in this last segment, I wanted to talk about an article that I wrote on my blog at mattcummins.com, where I discuss my first ever real live auction draft at NFBC. And this is, again, like I said earlier, sometime in the podcast, that I said this was a 15-team mixed league. So this is a league where you have 14 starting hitters. So two catchers, first baseman, second base, you know, middle infielder, corner, five outfielders, and a utility player. And you have nine pitchers. And then you also have six bench players. Or it's either six or seven. But anyway, So what's unique about this type of format is that there's no trading involved at all in this league. So once you draft a team, that is pretty much your team for the entire season. So again, this was a 15-team mixed league, and this is where everyone had a budget of $260. And how the auction went was everyone had to create a starting lineup with their money, with their $260. And then after that, we did a reserve draft where we went in snake order for drafting players. So I wrote an article on my blog about what my strategy was for the draft. So my approach was, so my approach on the draft was I wanted to spend a lot of money on hitting and I wanted to get my players. So I wanted to get Aaron Hill. I wanted to get, you know, Melky Cabrera. I wanted Everett Cabrera. I wanted Ryan Braun. I wanted Jason Worth. And I was able to get these players because I knew that I could still build a pretty good pitching staff with only $70. And that's because I relied on Corey Kluber and R.A. Dickey and Chris Tillman being undervalued. So I had all three of those guys as top 30 pitchers, but they were only going for $6. And I wanted to make sure that I, what I did was, okay, I said these three players will be top 30 pitchers. So what I did was I spent $26 on those three pitchers. Put that into context, like Adam Wainwright went for $24 and Kershaw went for $33. So I was able to get pretty good value, I believe, for $24 or $26, whatever it costs for those three pitchers. So I said, okay, I can be kind of cheap with my pitching and, you know, load up on hitters. So, and another thing I did was with my pitching staff was I wanted to make sure that I acquired two closers that I feel, first of all, would provide really good ratios as well as provide me a lot of saves. And those players were guys in the top tier. So I wanted like the Greg Hollins or the Trevor Rosenthal or David Robertson or Joe Nathan. So what happened was I was able to roster both Trevor Rosenthal and Joe Nathan for a combined maybe $30 or something like that, give or take, I guess. And so that was something I did on purpose. So what happened was I nominated and acquired those closers pretty quickly. I was able to get Nathan for $14, which is actually ended up being a pretty good price because players like John Axford went for like $13 later on in the draft. So I think that's a really tremendous value as well. And I also, my idea was I would draft dollar pitchers that had pretty good upside in terms of, okay, I would start them in favorable matchups. So for example, I drafted Tommy Malone and Eric Stoltz, for example. And my idea was that I would play them only at home. And then if you add those stats together, you know, it gives you 200 innings with a 3.4 ERA with 170 strikeouts. And that's a $15 pitcher. That would only cost me $2. And that was the idea. And of course, you know, today, Eric Stoltz pitched today in Miami, which I thought was a good matchup. He went ahead and got lit up for 4 innings and 5 earned runs, I think. Or was it 4 innings and 4 earned runs today? But either way, it's quite frustrating. But anyway, enough of that. So another thing was that I wanted to make sure I got catchers. So I read Larry Schechter's book, and he really opened up my eyes to position scarcity and how that does exist for catchers. And I actually got an opportunity to just go on a random tangent. I actually got an opportunity to say hi to him. I said hi for like a minute, then me being extremely shy, I just stood around with everyone else not talking and being kind of weird probably. But anyway, he seems like a cool dude, like a very smart guy. But anyway, so what I wanted to do was to make sure that I got my catchers. So I ended up with Joe Mauer and Jonathan Lucroy. And what happened was I nominated Lucroy really early as well. I think Lucroy was my second nomination. My first elimination was Ryan Braun, and I got him for the price that I wanted, which is probably going to be a waste of money now. But anyway, so then I nominated Jonathan Lucroy, and I saw that he went for $17 in Tout the weekend before. So I nominated him for $15. I nominated him for $2 less than what he went for in Tout. And then full knowing that if someone went up a dollar, then I'd quickly go up to the next dollar and be happy with that. So long story short, I rostered Jonathan Lucroy at a really good discount. So I got him for, it's either $15 or $17. But anyway, for the purposes of the story, I'll just say that I went for $17. So he went for $17, and then later on in the draft, other owners started to feel the scarcity of catcher, and prices for catchers went up dramatically. So what happened was Matt Wieters went for $18, and Salvador Perez went for $16. Now, you know, odds are, you know, depending on how you rank the catchers, you know, it's fairly likely that you have Jonathan Lucroy ahead of both those guys. And the fact that I was able to get him for pretty much a dollar less than Wieters and a dollar more than Perez means that I got a really good deal. So my initial idea or initial strategy was to, first of all, make sure I get my catchers that I wanted and to get the closers that I wanted before the scarcity comes in and other owners start overpaying for, you know, saves or for catchers. So from there, I went ahead and nominated a lot of my players that I had on my target list. So for example, I wanted to make sure that I nominated Jason Wirth, or that I nominated Aaron Hill, or that I nominated Everest Cabrera, or that, for example, I got Melky Cabrera for some reason. So I went ahead and did that first. So in the first half of the auction, I kind of had the most players on my team already because I wanted to make sure that I had the players that I wanted and went ahead and did it that way. And then in the second half, during the intermission, I realized that people were trying to price enforce me because they realized that the players that I nominated were the players that I wanted. So what happened was in the second half, I would nominate a pitcher for a dollar and then people would go to $2. So what I figured out was, okay, I'll nominate players that I want that are on my dollar list, but that I really, you know, don't really want that much. So for example, I threw out Mike Leake for a dollar and someone went to $2, and then that was the end of it. I did not go to another dollar because Mike Leake is only worth $1. And I did that a couple times with other pitchers like, I can't remember off the top of my head, but maybe for CC Sabathia, for example. You know, I thought, you know, entering the draft that he has a pretty good upside for a dollar, you know, because considering how bad he was last year, that, you know, for a dollar, the upside is worth it. But if you go more than that, then it's kind of too much. So I threw him out for a dollar, then someone went to $2, and then someone went to $3, and then he ended up being sold for $6 for some reason. So yeah, that's one way I helped stop people pricing enforcing me. So I did that. So another thing is that a lot of players in this league, when they nominated players at well below costs, what they should, or well below what their value is. So for example, people would throw out Jose Bautista for $10, which is, no one's going to pay $10. I mean, he's not going to go for that. He's going to go for, you know, $25. And a lot of players did that, and I never understood why they were doing that. I think they were trying to get discounts on players, or either they were trying to get money off the table. And, you know, that's fine if you want to do that, you know, in the middle rounds. If you were like me, like, that's what I ended up doing after I rostered, you know, maybe 50% of my team, because I wanted to get some money off the board, so I'd nominate high-priced guys. But in the very early beginnings of the draft, they would nominate players like Jose Bautista for $10, and, you know, nominating a player is very, very important because it gives you the advantage and it gives you the ability to nominate a player at a cost that you want. So, for example, what I did was towards the end of the middle rounds, I really wanted Corey Kluber, and I waited to the point where, you know, enough money was off the board that someone wouldn't price enforce me that much. So what I did was is that I saw that he went for $6 in Tat Wars. So I said, okay, if I throw him out for $6, I'm pretty sure that no one's going to go over $6. So I went ahead and did that. And I threw him out for $6, and that was the end of it. And I, you know, the auctioneer said going once, going twice, and that was it. And I got him for $6. Now, while others, some other players, like for example, a guy really wanted Ivan Nova, for example, from the Yankees, but he threw him out for $1, and then he ended up being sold for $5. So what happened was the guy who nominated him said, "Okay, I want." You know, $1. Then someone said $2. And then someone said $3. Then the guy who nominated him said $4. And then someone else said $5. And the guy who nominated him was kind of upset that he didn't get him. So but the thing is that if he nominated him for $5 originally, you would have had him, you know? But maybe he didn't value him as a $5 pitcher. Who knows? But it seems as though that the guy really wanted him and he couldn't really afford to pay $5 for him. Or $6 for him, sorry. So that was something that I've noticed with the draft. So, you know, for me, I wanted, when I nominated my players, I nominated them at the cost that I wanted to pay. So, you know, sometimes I nominated them, you know, at $2 or $3 below what my max bid was. But sometimes I went with my max bid because I didn't want to mess around and I wanted to make sure that I acquired the player that I wanted. So, but overall, I was happy with my draft. I executed the plan that I wanted, and you know, at the time I was really excited about the draft because I felt like that I got, you know, I did what I wanted to do, and in theory, if this worked out, I would have a really good offense, and my pitching staff would be, you know, middle of the road, which is fine because I know that I believe that I'm fairly good at streaming, so and working the waiver wire, and I knew that I could be able to find dollar pitchers for, you know, for low cost on the waiver wire throughout the year, but I wouldn't be able to find good hitting. So so that was my idea behind the draft. So, but overall, everyone that I met at NFPC was really cool and very nice, and you know, they all love fantasy baseball, and they're really smart people, and I'll definitely be doing it again next year. Now, I say that with a caveat. If my team does really poorly, then I probably may not want to do that again or play again. But we will see about that. But go to mattcummins.com and you can actually read what I just talked about. And it's actually, you'll learn more if you read it than from me talking about it. So, but okay, so that is the end of the podcast. I'm going to try to be doing these every Friday, so hopefully you enjoy these, and that is it. So have a great weekend, everyone. I'll talk to you later. Bye.